Hello and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. I'm Bob Wells. My guest today is Bill Cunningham, historian and tour guide. In today's episode, we're in South Lincolnshire, England, in historic Georgian market town of Stamford, once described by Sir John Betjeman as the most attractive in England. In this episode, Bill gives us a brief history of Stamford. We then go into some detail and hear the stories about five famous and in some cases infamous people who lived here. And finally, we discover how to find out more about the history of Stamford, which was recently named Best Place to Live by the Sunday Times. Bill has an amazing enthusiasm for history, has a brilliant grasp of the subject, and conveys his knowledge with some wry humour. I hope you enjoy this episode. Today, I'm in the wonderful Georgian market town of Stamford. It's about halfway between London and York, about 90 miles north of London. It's been used for things like films. Middlemarch was filmed here, the television series. It's got a population of about 20,000. And I've come to meet a close friend of mine who is a tour guide of Stamford. And so welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Tell us a bit about Stamford, Bill.
Well, Stamford's been around for quite a few years. It's really initially started with the Saxons. They built a little tiny settlement on the River Welland at the highest point of crossing that you can do. And they laid stones on the base of the river. Hence, Stamford was initially known as Stony Ford. And that's how it developed into Stamford. And this is the lowest point of crossing you could have between here and the sea. And therefore, that's how the town developed.
So I notice we're crossing a river at the moment. What river is this, Bill?
This is the River Welland.
Yeah.
It flows into the Wash, and it's critical to Stamford's development over the years because in years gone by, medieval times, the roads are rubbish, and it's much better to transport things by water. And here they could, where we're standing now, if you want to have a quick look, if you look down the river here, you'll see lots of buildings to the right.
Wow, yeah.
When you get to the far end, you'll see an old Georgian building. And that's an old wharf, for loading cargo. And you still see the bits where they load the boats up in years gone by.
So it's a beautiful day here. Bit cold, bit blowing. We just crossed the river, and there's some lovely Georgian houses made out of limestone, Bill.
Yeah, limestone. Yes, limestone. Stamford is a stone town, probably one of the finest stone towns in England. It's built on a layer of Jurassic stone that runs from Dorset up to North Yorkshire. And hence, it's up until recent times, it almost exclusively built in stone.
Great. Well, what we're going to do today is there's a lot to learn about in Stamford, but I think one of the things we'll do today is we'll actually find out about some of the people who are associated or lived in Stamford.
We're going to go to a grave first.
Oh, that's a nice sobering thought, Bill.
And we'll start off in a happy chappy called Daniel Lambert. And when we get there, I'll just run through that with you.
So we're just coming up to talk about the famous Daniel Lambert. Before that, let's just find out a bit about you, Bill. What makes you so interested in Stamford and history and stuff like that?
Essentially, I'm a retired businessman now, but all my life I had a passion for history. And now, as I've given up work, I'm fully exploring this passion.
Yeah.
I'm a guide at a local steady home called Grimsthorpe Castle, which is a wonderful, undiscovered, least well-known of the great English stately homes. And now I'm also a guide at Stamford Town. We're known as the Mayor's Guide, and we launch in about a week or two's time.
Oh, so it's a fairly new
venture,
set of guides,
yes.
Is it?
But we're under the direction of Jill Collins, who's a Blue Badge guide.
Yeah.
And she's been in the business for over 35 years. And it's been a great experience, learning and exploring about the history of Stamford. I knew a fair bit anyway, because I'm a bit of a history nerd.
Yeah.
And but now we're doing it properly.
Excellent. So what we'll do later on in the show, we'll talk a bit more about how people can find out more about the Mayor's Guides. So how far are we now from Daniel Lambert?
I'm going to turn left up this street here. We'll be at the graveyard in a couple of minutes.
Excellent. What sort of age are these buildings?
The ones we've gone past now are early 19th century.
Yeah.
They're actually the buildings of a brewery that was here, a malt house as well. You can tell these used to brew the beer.
It's interesting, actually, because every time I come to Stamford, there's always sign of an old brewery somewhere. There must have been more than one or two breweries there.
There were several. Because Stamford was a stagecoaching town between, it's halfway between London and York, and the stagecoaches used to ply their trade here, which meant you had a large number of very thirsty travellers, and hence the breweries were developed. And there's only one left now. It's more like a showpiece brewery. But
The inn that everybody's heard of, well, a lot of people have heard of, is of course the George.
Of course, yes.
Very famous.
Yeah, the George has been around a long time. It's been around close on 1,000 years. The current building is very early Georgian. But prior to that, during medieval times, it was hostelry to accommodate the many pilgrims who come to Stamford. Because in the early medieval times, Stamford was a very serious town with about over half a dozen monasteries and friaries and 14 parish churches. Therefore, we had a huge number of pilgrims come to visit the town.
Yeah.
And the George helped accommodate them.
Okay.
So, George is a more recent name for it.
Yeah. So we're just coming up to a cemetery now. And Daniel Lambert, here we've got a sign here. Daniel Lambert lies buried in his old churchyard of St. Martin's.
Yes, we've just crossed the river. So we're in the, they're calling it St. Martin's Without. So it's separated. You've got the north of the river used to be the Danish time, the Viking settlement.
Yeah.
South of the river was a Saxon settlement. So we're currently in the Saxon part.
Yeah.
Put up in 972 by King Edgar. Daniel Lambert was not a local man. He was actually from Leicester. And he was the son of the jailer of Leicester's jail. And he came to Stamford in 1809, and he had the misfortune to die here in one of the local inns. What it was, Daniel Lambert was famed because of the largest and fattest man in England. At the time of his death in 1809, he weighed just shy of 53 stone, and his thighs were a metre in circumference, and he was 3 metres around the waist. He was the son of the local, the Leicester jailer. Unfortunately, in 1805, the jail closed, and he had to exhibit himself. That was common in the time. So he'd travel around in a specially designed coach, and people would pay to see him. He spent a lot of time down in London, showing himself off. Strange enough, he was actually quite a favourite with the ladies in those days. Yes, the Georgians had very strange tastes. And he came to Stamford to exhibit himself, because in those days, Stamford, in Georgian times, was a very, very popular tourist resort. The communication was good because of the stagecoaches. And he came here and, unfortunately, he died. He weighed 53 stone, and it took 20 men to take his body out of the inn that he died in. They had to knock down the windows and the doors to get him here.
Wow.
And when they got to his grave, they couldn't just lower him into the grave. They had to build a sort of ramp over several feet to lower him down into it.
How old was he when he died?
He was 39. Not real, but then at that weight, you probably don't expect to live too long.
Yeah.
In his defence, he was not a glutton. He had a medical condition, genuine medical condition,
yeah,
which meant that he got very fat.
Yeah.
He also was virtually a teetotaler as well. He has been here for about 115
He's
years.
He's a permanent resident.
Permanent resident. Yeah, yeah.
So I can see his grave now. It's quite a big headstone, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Unusually, it's actually in slate. It's not in the local limestone.
It's got a width of nearly a metre, and it's about 1.5 metres high, and it's one of the largest gravestones in the cemetery, and it certainly stands out with its slate.
Slate you don't really get here. You'll find with Stamford, things are in stone. Because it's surrounded by very important quarries from medieval times. Barnack quarries very close by, and of course that's the one whereby cathedrals like Peterborough and Ely are constructed from Barnack stone.
Yeah.
And you've got Colley Weston, which is Colley Weston slate, which the roofs in Stamford you'll see are done in Colley Weston slate, or the older buildings are.
Yeah.
Which is a very skillful trade to run, to put on the ceilings. And
so they're still extracting the slate, are they?
They've just started up again. They'd shut down in the 60s,
yeah,
and they've just started. Yeah, because it's quite a complicated process.
So there's renewed interest in traditional stoneworking, is there?
Yes, there is. There is. I say up until the advent of the railways, Stamford was built of stone. Because you have to imagine in those days, you can't really transport stone very easily by road. Therefore, when the railways came along, you could get more stone in. So up until the railway time, the local stone was used. Then after the advent of the railways, stone from other parts of the country, or indeed overseas, was brought in.
Yeah.
And, of course, bricks as well.
Yeah. Before we move on to our next person, is there anything else we need to hear about Daniel Lambert that's of interest?
I think we covered the most of it. He's very popular with the ladies. He was also, after his death, his clothing was left in, I believe, the George, possibly. I'm not certain of that. And when Tom Thumb, the famous midget, came to visit in mid-Victorian times, Tom Thumb plus one of his lady friends managed to actually sit inside one of Daniel Lambert's pockets. So,
really? Thanks very much. So let's move on to our next person. So we're back now with Bill. We're at St George's Church, also known as St George's Square. This is, I think, where a lot of the Middlemarch series was filmed. You can really see the familiarity of the building. So, Bill, tell me all about this place.
Well, St George's Square is arguably one of the finest Georgian squares in the country, and certainly in the provinces. You're right, it has been used for filming. Middlemarch, a lot of Middlemarch was filmed here, and also Pride and Prejudice as well was filmed here. Right. Or sect. And to your left you see the building there, number 20. A very nice Georgian building, classical format, etc. But one of its most significant residents, shall we say, lived here in the 1920s. He was a chap who was called Arnold Lees. Arnold Lees, yes. He was, oddly enough, actually, a camel vet. And he was an extremely...
Sorry, can you just say that again?
A camel vet.
A camel
as
vet.
As in the creatures with humps. And he was...
They actually had guys that were specifically involved looking after camels.
So you've got to bear in mind, it's the days of the British Empire. We had India, we had that.
Yeah,
and he was a camel vet. He did time with the army. Yeah. In fact, they even have a camel's tick disease named after him as well. So he was well-renowned, but he moved to Stamford in the 1920s. And he's a chap who was a teetotal, vegetarian, animal lover, which was... probably suitable for his other great hero, Adolf Hitler, who was also another great humanitarian, teetotal animal lover. Because Arnold Lees was one of the first original members of the British Fascist Party.
Was he?
Run by Oswald Mosley.
Right, yeah.
Yes, he...
So we're talking, what, 1920s,
1930s? 1924
he came.
1924,
yeah.
And he was a great fan of Mussolini as well. Yeah, one of the... He actually claimed that Stamford were the first ones to introduce the black shirts for the British Fascist Party.
Yeah.
And he was very, very extreme indeed, extremely anti-Semitic. He actually found the Oswald Mosley's British Fascist Party a bit too moderate. In fact, his description of them, they were conservative with knobs on. So he found it, you know, not quite to his taste. So he ended up leaving Oswald Mosley's party and forming his own Imperial British Fascist Party. But in the end, he found Stamford a bit too quaint and mild for him. So he moved to the revolutionary town of Guildford and carried on from there. He was unrepentant. He was unrepentant with regard to Hitler. He was arrested in 1940 because he was obviously being a bit of a subversive.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to be arrested. When he started kicking the policeman who came to visit him, he wasn't arrested and interned. And he died in the 1950s. And oddly enough, in 1960, when the British National Party put up their new headquarters, they named it after himself, the Arnold Lees Building. So that was him. Also, Stamford has a bit more significance because Stamford is the only town or only place in England to elect members of the British Fascist Party to local office. They elected them, two of them, as councillors. And not only did they elect them once, they elected them twice. Now, whether that is something for Stamford to boast about, I'm not really too sure.
It's probably part of Stamford's history that they prefer to forget.
We'll call that the hidden or secret history, shall we say.
Yes, yes.
But probably not the finest of characters for the town to boast. No, but he came to live here in the 1920s and left to go to the hot spot that is Guildford.
Guildford, okay. So we're just coming up a cobbled street called Barn Hill. And Bill, you're going to tell us about somebody else now in Stamford?
Yeah, we're in Barn Hill, one of the finest streets in Stamford, and it's always been one of the richest streets in Stamford. And it's had many interesting residents over the years, but the property just opposite us, a fine Georgian building of 1740, one of its residents was a chap called Edward Edwards. He was a naval captain. His claim to fame was basically that he commanded HMS Pandora, and it was a ship that was sent out by the Admiralty to go and arrest the mutineers of the Bounty, who were then out in the South Sea Islands. So he sailed out there, And he managed to recapture the mutineers, or some of them anyway. And also, when the bounty mutiny occurred, there weren't enough room in the boat that Captain Bligh went on for all the loyal sailors. So he also arrested some of the loyal sailors who were also in the South Sea Islands and put them into prison along with the mutineers. So he recaptured a load of them, put them in cages on his boat. They called them Pandora's boxes. And he was a bit of a savage man, a flogger and a hanger and a beater. And unfortunately, he managed to get shipwrecked off the Australian coast. And he lost half the mutineers. And eventually, by the time he got back to London, he's put on court martial for being basically incompetent. But he managed to get off okay. And he was actually a local man. And he came back to Stamford. He ended up being an admiral, oddly enough. That shows how talented the Navy was in those days.
And admirable of him.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And he came back and he lived here for the latter years of his life and died in about 1809, an admiral of the fleet. But really, in general, not a particularly nice guy.
No, certainly a lovely property. And as you said earlier on, Bill, the properties around here are beautiful.
Oh, yes,
yeah. The cobbled streets and everything.
That's classic Georgian. What you call pattern book architects. You'd get the Bob the Builder would come round to see the client, and the client would flick through the Bob the Builder's pattern book to what he wants. And here you see it's a classic one. So this client is picked. The lower windows are of a particular style, very, very fancy. The upper windows, again, are a completely different style. And the dormer windows and ceiling, again, totally different. He just had one of everything,
Yeah. Basically,
so he could show off. Next door to the more plainer, earlier property, so he could say, I'm considerably richer than you, shall we say. Let's take a little bit of gander further up.
So we're just coming up a little hill here. Oh, that's a nice property, Bill.
Yeah, that's the largest private house in Stamford.
Just to give you an idea of what it looks like, it's very much a square building, probably built in, what, 1800s, 1700s?
No, 1698.
I wasn't far off.
But you were right in a way, because it was massively remodelled in the 1642. It was purchased by the second Marquess of Exeter, who are the local main aristocratic family. They live in a burly house across the water. And he purchased it for the visit of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert.
Yes.
And he redid the facings of it, so you were right, the frontage is actually Victorian. And he built it because Queen Victoria and Albert would come to visit Burleigh House, and he thought that it wasn't, he didn't have enough room. Because not only was Queen Victoria visiting, but also her ministers and Prime Minister. The Prime Minister at the time was Robert Peel, who founded the police force. And so he basically constructed that building. Lovely property, very grand. So Queen Victoria stayed down at Burleigh House, and Sir Robert Peel stayed just here. And when they left, it came in very handy because he used it to accommodate his mistress in future years.
So probably, no doubt, a few parties went on in that building.
I'd like to think so.
we'll move on. We're now at another part of Stamford, and I'm looking across at a building called the Old Rectory. We're on St Peter's Hill. Bill, are you going to tell me about somebody famous here?
Well, not somebody famous, or they were in their time, in the Victorian times. I touched on Edward Edwards, who was not a particularly pleasant character, so let's run through some more unpleasant characters. St Peter's Hill and leading St Peter's Square. In St Peter's Road, in this road there used to be a house which was owned and occupied by a chap called Thomas Bacon and his wife Martha. Thomas was born in Stamford, son of a sort of local, they call him Whitesmith and Blacksmith. He was a metal worker, quite well to do, reasonably.
Whitesmith?
Yes, yeah. He worked with metals, basically.
Well, I've heard of a blacksmith, yeah, but yeah. What's a whitesmith?
Well, they work with different types of metals. And so he was reasonably well to do, and he came to great fame in the 1850s because been accused of murder in an unfortunate way. Born in Stamford, got married here, not a very nice character. He was sued for a non-payment of bills. He defrauded the gas corporation because he diverted gas pipes into his house without paying for it. He got seduced the daughter of a local merchant and got her pregnant. Anyway, ended up marrying, and One occasion, his dad came round to... His dad owned the property here in St. Peter Street, and his dad had a nice meal with him, and about the following day, his dad was dead. And at his mother's funeral, he was heard to say... at his father's funeral, he was heard to say, well, only the mother to go now. And then she came round for lunch, and strange enough, she died a few hours later.
Bill, this guy doesn't sound like a very nice person.
Not really. It gets worse. His wife was called Martha, and she had a history of mental illness. And because he then just moved down to London with Martha, and they had two children anyway, and they moved down to London rather rapidly, actually, possibly because he wasn't really that popular in the town. So he got down to London, and within about 2 or 3 months of arriving in London, when he was supposedly down in Reigate on a visit, his wife claimed that the house was burgled and her two children had been murdered and she'd been attacked. So when the policeman went round there, sure enough, the little baby child in its chair downstairs with its throat cut, and upstairs was their two-year-old baby daughter, also with a throat cut. The police were a little bit suspicious, and the mother was put on trial, and she promptly blamed the murder on her husband. And so it went to trial. He was acquitted and she was found guilty, but was consigned to a lunatic asylum because she was mentally ill, which duly happened. However, it did create a bit of suspicion, because here we are in St. Peter's Street. He had his house here. His business wasn't doing very well, and his house had burnt down. Strange enough, burnt down, and the insurance had to pay out after a legal battle.
So this property over here, this is what was built over where his old house was.
Yeah, on this street was.
And what year are we talking?
His father died in 1854. Yeah. After having lunch with him, his mother died in 1855. After having lunch with him, he moved down to London not long after the mother's death. The house burnt down in 1855, and they just went down to London.
Right.
And that's when the two children were murdered. But because of all the trial caused a big sensation, not just in the UK, but also overseas. You know, child murder was one of those, you know, quite a big issue. And it focused on, well, hang about, what's happened to his mum and dad? So the police got involved and they went to Stamford and requested the exhumation of the mother's body. And after a bit of a legal wrangle, because the authorities didn't want to do it in case they found out they'd made a mistake, they did exhume the body, and after post-mortem, it's found it contained arsenic. So it was, in fact, murder. And it was traced that he, in fact, bought arsenic from a local chemist shop in Red Lion Square in Stamford shortly before his mother's death.
A very sad story.
Very sad, yeah. And one neighbour saw him when his mother was ill, the first time round, when she'd had the meal, she was ill, then had a bit of a recovery. So he went round to visit her with a bottle of medicine, which he gave to her, and then she died not long afterwards. So he went to trial and was actually found guilty of his mother's murder. Probably did his dad in as well. But strangely enough, he wasn't hung. He was actually sentenced to life imprisonment, because although they found him guilty of the murder, it was a pretty close shave to do it. Mm. And he ended up being transported to Australia.
Did he?
And died about 10 or 15 years later. Right. His wife, on the other hand, Martha, she lived for another 30 years after her husband's death. And she was one of the first, we'd call inmates, of the newly constructed Broadmoor Prison.
Yeah.
Which has come to fame as the home of many a famous psychotic murderer.
That's a very sad story, Bill.
So Stamford has got one or two unsavoury individuals.
For such a lovely town, I suppose, it puts a bit of a blight on it, really.
Yeah, true. But, like Thomas Bacon isn't well known now, but in Victorian times it was a major, major case. Yeah. You know, when you're implicated in the murder of your two young children, and also found guilty of the murder of your mother, and very possibly the guilty of your father, it doesn't make you the nicest person around.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Okay. Yeah. So, Bill, we've heard quite a lot about various people in Stamford. Is there anybody else you'd like to talk about?
Well, do you want another unpleasant person?
Bill, how many unpleasant people are there in Stamford? Have you got another one to talk about, then?
Oh, yes.
Come on, out with it.
Well, I won't take you to where he was born, because I think that's unfair of the residents who probably occupy that house at the moment. But Stamford was the birthplace of a chap called John George Haig. He was born in Stamford in 1909 and died in, I believe, about 1948 on the gallows. John George Haig was born here to a fairly middle-class family. They were primitive brethren, a very religious family, and he was brought up. And they moved away from the town when he was a teenager, and but he did come back regularly and stayed at the George quite regularly. He was basically a bit of a con man and a fraud, and he unfortunately defraud people out of their money and always get caught. And he had several spells in prison because each time he did a fraud, he'd get caught, found out. Basically because, and he sat in prison one day realising, the problem I've got is, I've been caught on doing these frauds. Why? Because my victims are still alive. So he hatched on a great way. And he had this theory that if the body couldn't be found, then no murder's been committed. So when he came out of prison, he did a few experiments involving acid. And so then he decided to defraud one of his friends and the parents of some money. He did that, and he invited his friend round to his house. And this was in London at this point of time, not Stamford or Hastings. He moved down to London. And he invited his friend round to his house, and he murdered him. And the method he got to dispose of the body was very simple. He had 40-gallon tanks of sulfuric acid. And he put the body into the tank of sulfuric acid, leave it there for about a fortnight. And at the end of the fortnight, he would literally pour the sludge down the drains that he had in his specially adapted garage. And he did that on several occasions. And he defrauded someone, claimed the rights to their property or whatever, and get rid of the bodies after he'd murdered them. Unfortunately, he came to his comeuppance when... he moved house.
When you say unfortunately, fortunately for the rest of the people living near him.
Yeah, he moved house and he didn't have the same drainage system. No. And he murdered a mature elderly lady who he'd befriended, and he defrauded and murdered her. But suspicion started to be aroused because, you know, it'd been noticed that he'd been known to her.
Yeah.
And she was a resident in a local hotel. And the police got suspicious, so they decided to search his house. But because he hadn't had the drainage system in, he'd actually just poured the sludge in the back garden, and the police managed to extract from the remainder of the sludge her dentures, the acid would not dissolve. And then they also traced it back, and he was put on trial, and his defence was a couple of features. A, there's no body, therefore I can't be found guilty of these murders. Also came various things like he was a vampire. Yeah, he was a bit of a loose character, but anyway, he's found guilty, and the due process of the law proceeded, and he was hung. And so he's now known as John George Hague, the acid bath murderer. But I have to stress, he may have been born in Stamford, but he did his murders in London.
Well, I should hope so, too.
Because
so
you don't want to go down that there.
No. So we've had quite a few stories, Bill, about various people, various famous people that have been associated with Stamford, which has been great. We've ended, really, on two characters that are probably we don't want to know a lot more about. Is there anybody else that you'd like to talk about that we can leave on a more positive note, that somebody perhaps who's been famous in Stamford?
The most famous person that people would perhaps know would be Malcolm Sargent, the famous orchestra conductor. He was born and bred in Stamford. He lived in Stamford. He was his father was an organ player, and he also himself learned to be an organ player at one of the parish churches of St John's. And he was a nice chap, became very famous, and he didn't kill anybody, he didn't flog anybody, and he ended up being a Knight of the Realm. He died in the late 1960s. This was his hometown. Yeah. He lived here. Obviously, he made his fame when he moved down south to that there London. But the sound is still very proud of him.
Yeah.
Local schools named after him, and they have various concerts to do with him. And we can end on a bit of a higher note with regard
to
self.
Bill, it's been fantastic talking to you, hearing about all these characters in Stamford. So thank you ever so much for your time. Before you go, where can people hear more about you and what you're doing?
Basically, I do guided tours of Stamford, known as the Mayor's Guides, and we start at the Town Hall steps, and we do that about 4 days a week. And if you search on our website, www.thestamfordtowntourguides.co.uk, and you're able to find out a bit
more. We can put that in the show notes after the program. Yeah. Are you on other things like Facebook, Instagram? That sort of thing as well?
I'm a bit of a nerd, bit of a dinosaur when it comes down to technology. Yes, I am on Facebook, but not in an official, just as an individual.
Well, like I say, all that stuff we can put on. Yep. Anything else you want to say about the Mayor's Guides?
If you want a nice tour of Stamford, I won't go into the things what we just discussed. I don't make it gloomy about that. But there we'll talk about the buildings, the architects, and the history.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I don't go into John George. No. That's really not the thing to do with a tour of people.
Once again, Bill, thanks ever so much for your time. And we'll speak soon. Thank you. Very much. Go to today's guest, Bill Cunningham, historian, stately home guide, and one of Stamford's mayor's guides. Check out the show notes for more details. You have been listening to Undercurrent Stories. I hope that you enjoyed the show. Please subscribe to the show for future episodes, and if you like what you hear, please rate and leave a review. Until next time, this is Bob Wells, wishing you all the very best.